Senate Agriculture and Veterans Affairs Budget Division will come to order, and...
I'm sorry about that. We'll come to order. We are going to start with the... it's Dairy Day on the Hill today at the Capitol, and... Okay. If the people that are going to testify would like to come up to the table, we'll hear from Robin Kinney, the Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Agriculture, Pat Luneman, President of Minnesota Milk Producers Association, Bob Lefebvre, Executive Director of Milk Producers Association, and David Ward, Cooperative Network. If you'd come up to the table, we'll begin, and hopefully that'll coax some of our senators to come to the committee meeting. So, Robin, we go back a long ways. Good to see you.
Good afternoon,
all the way back to my Farm Bureau days back in the early 90s. So it's good to see you here. So if you want to begin, we'd certainly be glad to hear from you.
It'd be my pleasure. Thank you to Senator Coring, and thanks to the committee for inviting us to report today on Dairy Day here at the Capitol. I've been asked today to give a couple of brief comments about the livestock investment grant that was signed into law last year, and I'd be happy to do that, and I will touch briefly on the Dairy Profitability Enhancement Program. My name is Robin Kinney. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and I oversee the non-regulatory divisions. The real value to Minnesota agriculture producers is the ability for us to use and identify a need, roll up our sleeves, and work together. And I believe that the Livestock Investment Grant is a perfect example of that partnership. Commissioner Hugeson, Chairman Vickerman, and Chairman Junkie developed and administered a competitive application program that offered producers making an investment in livestock production the opportunity to recapture 10% of the cost of specific investments. That Livestock Investment Grant program last year had $1 million appropriated for grants and administrative costs. There were 576 producers who submitted applications with investments totaling just over $150 million. Dairy producers submitted 64% of our applications. 16% were from beef producers in the state, and 15% came from the pork industry, and the remainder from other segments of our livestock industry. A couple of interesting facts we found: 37% of the total grant applicants had been farming for 15 years or less, and 27% were under the age of 36, 60% in between the age of 36 to 55. As we take a look at the 38 grants that were awarded today, I can tell you that 29 of those projects have already received their checks. A total of $749,000 has already been given to those producers to help them recapture that cost. We think it was a very highly successful program. And more importantly, in a day and age when we are watching an economy possibly on a slippery slope, we can tell you that over $150 million of investment was made by those 576 applicants alone. The ripple effect of that totals nearly $741 million that went out in local economic activity and about 951 new jobs just from the applicants. So the Livestock Investment Grant Program was highly successful. Touching briefly on our Dairy Investment Enhancement Program, this program was a pilot program that began in 1996, and the appropriation was increased to $2 million a year in the biennium of 2004 and 2005. There's two primary components to the program: dairy diagnostic teams and dairy business planning grants that offer a maximum cost share of $5,000. Last year, the dairy teams worked with 423 dairy farms representing over 55,000 cows in the state. That's from six regional groups and a statewide sustainable farming association. In 2008, the dairy business grants also awarded 45 farmers a total of $203,000. We've consulted with over 4,000 dairy farmers in the state of Minnesota through this program. Again, it's been highly successful. Specific projects have included reduction in the quality counts, initiatives designed to help dairy farmers reach profitability with milk quality, a dairy website, And this past year, a very successful egg recycling project for plastics that are found on our dairy farms. As a short snapshot of the dairy industry and the two programs that I was asked to comment on today, Senator Coring, and I'd be open for questions, I'd like to introduce my colleague to the right, Quinn Cheney, who is our Director of Policy at the Department of Agriculture.
Senator Engelbrechtson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question on the recyclables. Can you tell me how that program works?
Yes. We put together a pilot project with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and encouraged recycling of agricultural plastics in a couple of targeted areas. That project was successful in eliminating about 50 tons of plastics from our waste area, was recycled into reusable projects. I believe there were collections points in Stearns County and also possibly in Winona County. I'm not sure that site got up underway. We've had a lot of interest from local recyclers about participating in the program, and that pilot project was highly successful.
Well, thank you, Assistant Commissioner, and I just want to say I think you're a great asset to the department. I know you were a great asset to Farm Bureau when you were there, and I certainly think you're a great spokesman for the department, so thanks. Luneman?
Luneman,
okay. President of the Minnesota Milk Producers Association.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Coring. Members of the committee, Pat Luneman, President of Minnesota Milk Producers, and also a dairy farmer from Todd County, which is in Senator Ingebrigtsen's district, and just a stone's throw away from Fort Ripley. To hear the thunder, it's a little quieter these days.
It is a little.
Anyway, I would like to give an overview of the dairy industry, and to start off with, it's not very pretty. In fact, the existing dairy situation is what I would call a crisis out on the farm these days. And it's created by what I would call a perfect storm, and we had rising milk production, which us dairy farmers, we like to do because we do what we do so well all across the United States. And so we were getting where we had like 1 or 2%, maybe too much milk than what we should have. And at the same time, with the economic downturn that we have across the United States, we're seeing a slight decrease in consumer consumption. And our exports, which were very strong last winter and into the summer, started to go down. And part of that is due to the strength of the dollar, which seems kind of strange considering where our economy is at today. But when we look at the whole world situation, the dollar is strong, which makes our exports, the demand for them weaker because they're higher priced. And also the banking crisis has created a problem in that our buyers, both domestic and international, are having difficulty finding credit to buy our dairy products. So those things put together have put us in a tough situation where prices are dropping. But I want to tell you that this downturn is different than other low cycles we've seen, and it seems like every 3 years we have a downturn in milk prices. But this time, it's different because our costs are so much higher than they have been in previous. When we look at feed, the milk feed ratio that we use in our industry to determine, you know, the affordability of buying feed and milking cows and making a profit, since that term was invented in 1985, currently today we are at the lowest milk price to feed ratio that we have ever had. And it's at a ratio of 1.69, which means takes we can buy 1.69 pounds of feed with a pound of milk, and usually three is the threshold. If it's over three, then it's profitable to buy feed and milk cows. So, but it's not only feed; it's all costs are so much higher. And today, what we're seeing in the industry is that our variable costs, or maybe you could call it cash costs, are actually higher than what we're paid for the milk that we're selling. A typical break even on a dairy farm is in that $15 to $16 per hundredweight area, and our current price as I speak today is $10 to $11. So you can, if you do the simple math, you can see that it's a pretty tough time for producers out there, and that it's going to be difficult on the balance sheet. It's going to require a lot of meetings and visits with the banker in order to continue. How long will this last?
We don't know.
Depends on where the economy is, how fast we get our production under control. And hopefully it doesn't last long. I fear that we'll lose a lot of our good producers across our state. Now, when we take a step back from our immediate crisis, let's look at how Minnesota is doing in the big picture, how we've been doing over the past few years. I would like to say that we've made a drastic turnaround in our industry to where we were adding milk and adding cows. Now, we've lost a few producers, but our industry has stabilized to where we're growing. And I feel confident that we can keep it that way. And the reason I'm saying that is when we look at the macroeconomic picture, the higher feed costs that we're seeing across the United States, and if you look at a chart or a graph, you'll see that they're about twice of what they were traditionally 10 and 20 years ago. We believe that that's what will bring the cows back to the Midwest from the West Coast, is the higher feed cost. Now, is it difficult for us in the short term?
Yes, it is.
But we're in the driver's seat here because this is where the feed is. Producers in Minnesota are making changes to restore their competitiveness. And when I talk about our producers making changes, it's not just the big ones. It's all types. And in Minnesota milk producers, we have all types. Remember, we represent the grazers, the traditionals, those who have the new facilities with lots of cows. And we're all making changes to be viable into the future. And you look at the grazers, they're learning, they're changing their operations, they're fulfilling a need that the marketplace has and a desire for their product. When we look for small and medium-sized producers, we're putting in low-cost parlors and other technology that makes them efficient and makes them competitive in our industry. When we look at our medium to large-sized herds, we're talking about greening of the dairy industry because they're putting in digesters, creating methane, separating the solids to recycle those solids. And we have no better example than like Jerry and Linda Jennison, medium-sized producers from Stearns County who put in a methane digester and are powering not only their farm but other homes in their area. And looking at some of our larger operations out by Morris, the Riverview and West River, they're putting in digesters, they have moon covers, creating energy, they're recycling their nutrients, they're sending it to other farms down the road. A lot of good things going on in our industry that I feel very proud of. Minnesota's producers want to be sustainable. We want to be environmentally friendly, significant contributors to our communities and our state's economies. And the reason we want to be that way is because we live there. We want to make a positive difference in our community from a personal perspective, an environmental perspective, and an economic perspective. I'm going to shift now to Minnesota Milk's top priorities. One of the key ones is environmental compliance. Some of you know we have a 2010 feedlot
deadline
whereby we all have to come to compliance. There are plenty of ramifications on that. At Minnesota Milk, we know that there's been some discussion at the Capitol about extending that deadline, and we're not sure that we need to do that, but we need to know from our legislators, from the administration, that if producers are working to be in compliance and are working diligently toward that end, that they will not be shut down if they do not meet the 2010 deadline. We have a significant need for cost share dollars to get the remaining producers in compliance, and those dollars have been hard to come by, and hopefully we can get some help on that to finish up the compliance issue. I think if we just work together, the state and our producers and all of our entities in between, we can get this job done. Permitting has been an issue for producers across Minnesota. It's been our experience at Minnesota Milk to modify, expand, change operations, whether it be to grow animal numbers or to just make our farms more friendly to our producers and our livestock. It's difficult to get permitted. The hoops that we have to jump through in different townships, counties, and areas of Minnesota tend to be different. And we would like to see that streamlined. When we go in
for a permit,
we should know that there is an outcome that we can bank on if we jump through the right hoops. And we want to make changes to our operation to improve our animal care, sustain our natural resources, and improve our rural economies. In a time of budget deficits, we should be looking at streamlining the layered and duplicative government permitting process. I know at times we have arguments for what levels we should have the permitting at. Our argument is to have the permitting at a level whereby it's professional for everyone involved, be it the adjoining landowners, people in the community, and for the farmer or producer himself. So that's the key point that we want you to understand. The Livestock Investment Grant. We all worked very hard to get that bill passed last year, and it would be a tragedy to see that bill
diminished or done
away with. And I want to read some points, and Robin Kinney had covered a few of these in her presentation. 576 producers sent in applications for the grant with total investments of $150,432,136. And out of the $1 million that were appropriated, only 38 applicants were able to be funded.
And we're going to
hear from Sadie Frericks here in a minute about that. She was one of the lucky ones that was funded. The
900 jobs
that were added based on the applications.
And the other
impact that we have on our communities, those dollars that are invested because of this, you know, have a significant impact on our local dealers and what they're able to sell, and you know the impact that has on our communities. So we need to keep this program. We at Minnesota Milk believe the Livestock Investment Grant should be fully funded. Dairy Development and Profitability Enhancement Program. All I can say is what a success that program has been for the dairy industry in Minnesota. We know it's had an impact, and I'm going to go back, and it's, again, Department of Ag Statistics on this program. The dairy profit teams last year in 2008, for each dollar that was invested through the Dairy Development and Profitability Enhancement Program, had a $75 return. The $75 return on $1 invested. The in-kind contributions from the industry, whereby we're bringing in people from veterinarians and bankers and farm management people that are donating their time or doing it at a lower cost, the in-kind contributions from the industry were $1 million. So they matched this grant, so to speak. And that's something that we shouldn't look away from. Statewide, there were 423 farms and 55,226 cows that had dairy profit teams, 9% of the farms and 12% of the cows, respectfully. As we look at these dairy profit teams, traditionally, they serve for different purposes. Right now, in this difficult time in the dairy industry, it might be to help producers figure out a way to get through this economic crisis. It might be to help them better their operations if they haven't already done that. It could be to help them go to the next step. Maybe they want to bring in
new blood
to the operation, a son or daughter or son-in-law or daughter-in-law. And these dairy profit teams bring people together to think this through so that our dairy farms are successful.
At
Minnesota Milk, we know it's a difficult budget time right now, but we believe this is one of those programs you just can't walk away from. It needs to be fully funded. So in summary, while we are currently in a downturn, we must not lose sight that Minnesota is a great place to dairy. All of us at Minnesota Milk believe that our producers, our farms, and our cows are a major contributor to our economy, and that by working together we can move forward an industry that is sustainable, renewable, and positive for our state. And Senator Coring, if I could at this point, rather than take questions, I would like to introduce Sadie Frericks, who has a great story to tell because she and her husband have been involved with the Livestock Investment Grant and Dairy Profitability Teams. And she has a great story to tell, and I'll hand it over to her if that's
okay. Actually, before that, Senator Scully has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want you to clarify a number. I wanted to make sure. Maybe you could even send it to me so I have documented of it. You said that there was 500 and some applicants for the grant program. 38 were approved, but 900 jobs. Was the 900 jobs a direct result of the 38, or is that what would have been you would have if you could, we could have funded everybody?
I would have to get back to you on that, Senator Scully. And this is a... This is actually a Minnesota Department of Agriculture report, so and, I'll check with them on that.
Yeah, and so, Mr. Chair, if you
could Coy.
Also, you talked about the total amount of investment. If we could get that number also, that would be great to help make us make the case when, you know, to maintain this program. And
okay, we can do that.
Thank you for your advocacy for the dairy industry. Appreciate it. Is it Sadie Farrick?
Sadie Frericks.
If you could just state your name one more time for the record, and then go ahead with your testimony. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sadie Frericks. I'm a dairy farmer from Melrose, Minnesota. My husband and I milk 50 cows there in the center of Stearns County. We've been farming for almost 4 years now. We met in college at the University of Minnesota, and after graduation worked off the farm for several years. In the spring of 2005, my father decided to discontinue his dairy enterprise and gave us an opportunity to try dairy farming for ourselves. We sold our house in town and moved up to my dad's farm in Aiken County and started farming. In June of 2006, we decided that we thought we could make a go of this, and so we purchased his cows and heifers and I guess made our commitment to dairying. In August of 2006, we accepted an unexpected offer from Sam and Jane Sulzel, some friends of Glenn's family, to work on their dairy farm as herdspeople for 1 year while Sam recovered from a brain injury resulting from an accident. So with our first child on the way, a newly purchased herd of cows, and a year of farming under our belt, we packed up and moved to Stearns County with our dairy cows and our baby calves. Halfway into our year with Sam and Jane, we assembled a dairy profit team to help us map out a plan for our transition back to dairy farming on our own, not knowing where we would go when we were done with our year's work as herdspeople. We also started looking for farms to rent, figuring that that was our best option after working for this family. At our first dairy profit team meeting, our team made it very clear that our first choice should be purchasing a farm. I still remember sitting at the table with our loan officer and him telling us that 20 acres with a milking center, a house, and some land nearby to rent for under $250,000 would be perfect. We thought he was crazy, that the odds of finding that perfect farm were staggering. We'd looked at every farm in within a 20-mile radius, and there weren't really any that fit that bill. But we followed their advice anyway and began looking for farms to purchase instead of just farms to rent. Our dairy profit team also recommended that we apply for a dairy business planning grant at that time to help us fund the process of purchasing a farm and looking into what would be involved in becoming farm owners. So we started that process as well. Within a month of looking, we had found exactly what we needed. A 20-acre farm site with a newer tie stall barn, a nice house, and the option of renting the remaining 140 acres of land that came with the farm. Even better, the farm was located in the middle of a strong dairy community, just across the road from Sam and Jane Sulzel's, and within a couple of miles of Glenn's family. The for sale sign had greeted us each day as we drove into Sulzel's yard, but we had never considered buying the farm because we didn't think farm ownership was an option for us, and we thought the price tag was out of our reach. So with the purchase agreement in hand, our dairy profit team continued to help us through the transition process. Our team met with us to walk through the farm and plan for the physical move of ourselves and our cattle to the farm. And our farm business management instructor helped us prepare the financial information needed by our loan officers to proceed with the purchase. In June of 2007, the purchase was finalized and we moved to the farm. We were awarded a dairy business planning grant and used those funds to define operation and financial plans for the new farm. We found the process of developing that plan very helpful in terms of identifying this new farm's potential strengths and weaknesses, and also identifying the areas that needed to be improved. I can honestly tell you that without our dairy profit team and our dairy business planning grant, I wouldn't be sitting in front of you as a dairy farm owner. We'd probably still be renting a farm somewhere, and I really don't like to think about what would have happened if we hadn't found a farm. We probably would have exited the industry. Purchasing the farm was a dream come true for us, but it was also good for our local economy. The farm we bought could easily have been sold to a non-farm buyer, and that non-farm buyer would not have had nearly the economic impact we have. In June of 2008, we began improving our farm. We installed long day lighting in the barn, put in stall mattresses for the cows, replaced exhaust fans, bought a TMR mixer wagon and a feed conveyor, and installed a plate cooler to reduce our electricity costs. We knew when we bought the farm that there were manure lagoon issues and feedlot runoff issues, and so last October we started a comprehensive manure management improvement project to correct those issues. We replaced the farm's stacking pit with an up-to-code manure lagoon and constructed diversions to keep feedlot runoff out of the pond that we share with our neighbors. Our improvement projects resulted in more business for a number of local dealerships and contractors. Our improvement projects also allowed us to become better stewards of our land and our natural resources. The environmental benefits of these improvements will continue long into the future. The investments we made in our farm played a big role in making 2008 a successful year for us. Our farm generated nearly $250,000 in economic activity above and beyond the investment we made in our manure lagoon. Those dollars went to the feed mill, equipment sales and service companies, the grocery store, and many other businesses. We applied for a livestock investment grant to help recover some of the dollars we invested in these projects, and in October, we were notified that our grant application would be funded. I was so excited, I did cartwheels all the way out to the barn to tell Glenn. We will receive our grant funds in 2009, which will help us, along with the continued guidance of our dairy profit team, to keep our business moving forward through the low milk prices the next few months are forecasted to bring. I believe that full funding for the Dairy Development and Profitability Enhancement Program is essential. Again, as I mentioned earlier, I would not be here today had it not been for our involvement with the program. The Livestock Investment Grant was extremely helpful as well. 10% lower costs for the improvements we made mean that we will be able to make future improvements in our farm 10% sooner than we had without those funds. Thank you for hearing my story today, and thank you for investing in Minnesota's dairy industry and young farmers like myself.
Well, thank you very much for that story. It's, you know, I would say that the Senate has not been hearing a whole lot of optimistic stories, and so it's nice to hear a success story, and we wish you all the success. Senator Engelbrechtson, I believe you had a question a while ago. If you still do, I'd recognize you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been a while ago. I might have forgotten what it was,
but
I have some questions and a couple of comments. So thank you also for that very wonderful testimony. It's nice to hear we're, again, as Senator Dill said a couple of weeks ago with regards to a program, government does work, and it's nice to be part of that. The question I had for the gentleman, in fact, this gentleman was one of the first through my door, actually, after being elected. As you all know, I met an awful lot of lobbyists in my first year and to get myself acclimated, and Pat was one of the first through the door, and I know how passionate he is about his business. But you talked about the ratio between feed versus production. There certainly is a difference between purchasing feed and raising your own feed, is there not? Is there a different ratio then, or is that the same?
Mr. Luneman?
Mr. Chair, as we look at our dairy farms as businesses, we do segment, we enterprise our farms, so to speak, and we may grow the crops in the field, we bring it to the cows, sell it to the cows. So you may have a profit in the field, but when you sell it to the cows, if you understand where I'm going there, the net effect with the low milk prices is that it's just very, very difficult to make a profit. The cows are losing money, so the earnings that you would receive from growing the crops probably are being used to offset that. So even though you grow your own crops, it's still a difficult time period, if that's the answer to your question.
That's great. And follow-up, thank you. Thank you for that answer. Just a comment from here, you know, with the feedlot deadline 2010 and the regulations that you're having to deal with, there's also this rumor that's looming out there. And I talked to some of the producers in my office earlier with regards to this carbon footprint per animal. I don't know if you've heard about that. That's coming. I'm not sure where that's coming from. I don't know if some people just make those kinds of things up or what, but I certainly am concerned about that, and I think we need to be aware of that, and I understand that's probably for larger groups, larger producers. I hope that doesn't come down the pike here in Minnesota, but nevertheless, it's something that I'm certainly interested in. And what are your feelings in your role as the president of the Milk Producers Association about something like that coming down the pike?
Mr. Luneman.
We can view this as a problem or an opportunity. And those of us in the dairy industry that have thought about this for a while believe this could be an opportunity for us as we look at methane digesters, look at selling carbon credits. We need to think about this in a positive manner. It could be negative if it's not done correctly, but I think it can be a good thing. I think we can be in the driver's seat on this and being part of renewable fuels. And as we look to the future in growing crops, we're going to be raising crops. We may not be feeding corn grain to our cows. They might get enough out of our forages because the forages are so good that we're raising in Minnesota. So rather than think of raising switchgrass, maybe we need to think about raising fiber for cows that the cows then convert into food, and then the waste from the cows is converted into energy. There's a number of possibilities that we can think of. And as we're capturing methane from cows, we can also capture those carbon credits and get some dollars from people elsewhere.
Thank you, and I'd just like to finish with one comment.
I'm just
wondering if you'd be so able to enlighten us as to whether you can do cartwheels. Can you do cartwheels? Thank you. That's
never could.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions from members? Actually, I have a question. Mr. Luneman, is there any data that you know of? When the milk price skyrocketed, a lot of dairy farmers had contracted. And I know of a big dairy farm in my district. He told me that he lost $1 million because he contracted, and then it went up. And it's my understanding that now a lot of dairy farmers were afraid to contract, and now there isn't very many contracts out there. Is that true, or can you enlighten us on that? Or
I can enlighten you because I've lived that same experience, Senator.
Okay.
In the past 2 years, contracting at the level that I had, it was a detriment. For the month of January, it was definitely a good thing. And I made the point of trying to be consistent. But I know that a lot of producers out there felt like they were burned by doing contracting, so they just said, this isn't working. I can't do this again. And now that we're in a downturn, they wish that they had.
Mm-hmm.
The whole point is you need to get contracts at a point that are profitable. And then the other thing is, with our expenses changing so drastically over the last couple of years, be it energy or feed or supplies, it's difficult to lock in that margin if you only do it on the milk side. And so we're learning the hard way in our industry. In fact, some of our dairy publications now say manage your margins. Well, we've kind of been taken to school, so to speak. So there are good ways of doing it. If you're out of the market, then you're totally at the risk of the market. You're in the market, if things move on you and you don't have your margin locked in, it can be very difficult. So I wouldn't say that contracts are bad in general. It's how they're managed. And all of us second-guess ourselves.
Okay. The committee thanks you for your testimony. Appreciate it very much. So if we could have, and I'm sorry about the pronunciation of the name. Is it Lefebvre? Lefebvre? Lefebvre. Okay.
Lots of
okay.
Mr. Chair, I took Mr. Lefebvre's place.
Oh, you did. Okay. All right. Then David Ward, the Cooperative Network. Is David here? Okay. If you could state your name for the record and then go ahead and proceed with your testimony, it would be much appreciated.
David Ward with the Cooperative Network, and I have one of those names that are very easy to pronounce.
we like your name.
And before I get on with my comments, Senator Scoy's question about 950 jobs, those are reflective of all the applications. The grant was only provided out of 500 and some applications, was only provided to 38 of the 576 applications. But a lot of those projects went forward without the grant. And so that's reflective of not only the ones that received the grant and the work that they did, but the ones that went forward even though they did not get the grant, and it created the 950 some jobs. So that's just to kind of clarify. And that's all in a nice little booklet put out by the Minnesota Department of Ag on the livestock investment grant. As I stated earlier, my name is David Ward. I'm with the Cooperative Network, and we're the Cooperative Trade Association for the state of Minnesota and the state of Wisconsin. We represent cooperative interests in both states. And as you probably well know, Minnesota is the number one cooperative state in the nation. There are probably close to 1,000 cooperatives in Minnesota, and those cooperatives serve about 3 million Minnesota citizens. So Minnesota is the number one state in the country for cooperative activity. And Wisconsin runs a close second. So weeks ago, Governor Plenty and Governor Doyle decided that they should get together and see how the Minnesota and Wisconsin could work better together. Well, cooperatives in both states have been doing it for years, and it's worked out well for both of us. 90% of the milk produced in Minnesota is marketed through one of our dairy cooperatives here in the state of Minnesota. So we're proud to be here as a participant in Dairy Day at the Capitol. I guess, first of all, I'd like to thank you for the work that you've done and the help that you provided us in the past with programs like the Livestock Investment Grant Program and the milk truck weight exemption that was passed last session, because that we found ourselves in the dairy industry at a point in time where we either had to obey a federal rule on picking up milk and at farms, or obey a state rule on load restrictions on some of our small spring weight restrictions on some of our rural Minnesota roads. So exempting milk trucks was very important to the industry. The challenges that you face in this upcoming session are enormous with the budget situation that you're looking at. But I want to kind of, as batting cleanup, I get to repeat a lot of things that have been said in the past. But the Livestock Investment Grant Program is a program that has provided a lot of benefit to not only to the livestock industry in the state of Minnesota, but the rural economy in Minnesota in general. The 950 jobs that have been talked about time and time again, those are jobs held by contractors, held by workers on farms, held by Main Street businessmen that benefit from having investment done in the rural areas across their state. So it's not just for livestock. It provides a benefit to the entire economy in the state of Minnesota. And I commend the Department of Ag for tracking the program. The Livestock Investment Grant Program is kind of modeled after a dairy investment tax credit that we have that's in place in Wisconsin. And the problem, we know the investment that was made, but we have very little idea of the ripple effect that investment benefited in rural Wisconsin. So by the department tracking that ripple effect, we're able to demonstrate that the program has been more successful not only for livestock, but for everybody else in the state of Minnesota. Permitting will continue to be an issue in rural Minnesota. I think Minnesota livestock producers and dairy producers want to, number one, have a permitting process that is designed to protect the environment and the natural resources of the state of Minnesota. But they also want to have a permitting process that is clear, more defined, and predictable. So going into the process, they know if they answer the questions that are required of them to answer, they can see some light at the end of the tunnel, not get three-quarters of the way through the permitting process and find out they have five more pages in their application that they decided they needed to be filled out. So they want a more clear, defined, and maybe take away some of the regional problems where one county has one set of rules and the county over has another set of rules. So I guess a more clear, defined permitting process to provide some more predictability, protect the environment, and allow the industry in Minnesota to grow even more than it has in the past couple of years. With a deadline on the feedlot rules fast approaching, I think the cost share money to help the smaller Minnesota producers, because most of the large Minnesota producers have already complied with the feedlot rules, so it's the smaller producers that are facing the deadline and are going to need cost share money to help them comply with the feedlot rules. So again, you've got a very difficult task in front of you this session, but I want to thank you for the work that you've done in the past. It's been very helpful, and hopefully by giving you some of the background of the benefits of some of the programs you've passed in the past, you will look on them favorably when you're facing your difficult choices in the next couple months. So I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ward. Any questions? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Ward. Now I guess we'll take up Senate File 132, Senator Dill, Veterinarian Education Loan Forgiveness Program. And I believe we also have two testifiers on the list here. Dr. Trevor Ames, Dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine, University of Minnesota, and Tom Peterson, Minnesota Farmers Union, if you'd step up to the table there. Senator Dill, do you want to explain your bill?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, Senate File 132 is a bill that is designed to encourage large animal veterinarians to go out to the distant parts of our state to practice large animal or food animal medicine. The average veterinarian graduating this year is going to be looking at $148,000 of student debt. And in order to service that debt, a lot of them are going to be thinking twice about going out into a large animal practice. They may be more attracted to a small animal practice where they can make bigger and better money and easier money. And there's a lot of veterinarians that are getting up in age and are going to be retiring. There's areas of the state that are not served by a veterinarian at this time because of the changes in the farm economy and so forth. And so the bill before you sets up a program in the Minnesota Department of Agriculture that will provide up to $15,000 per year of loan forgiveness if the veterinarian agrees to practice in a distant rural area of the state. Now, if you take a look at the bill, there's some things I want to point out to you in the bill. If you can drag up out of your folder, the first page on lines 1.12, it defines where these designated rural areas are where a veterinarian may go to be eligible. And basically, it excludes the metro area, which would be Anoka, Carver, Dakota, Hennepin, Ramsey, Scott, and Washington counties. And it also excludes some of the areas where you would consider to be regional centers out in the country, Duluth, Mankato, Moorhead, Rochester, and St. Cloud. So the veterinarian would have to go to an area of the state other than those that are identified there. And I want to draw your attention on page 1 to line 1.23, the bottom of page 1. The establishment of this program will be done by the Commissioner of Agriculture, but the participant must agree to practice in a designated rural area that is considered underserved. And if you turn the page to page 2, on lines 2.1, you must work full-time in a practice that is at least 50% involved in the care of food animals. And then if you drop down to line 2.15 on page 2, under loan forgiveness, the Commissioner of Agriculture may select a maximum of 5 applicants per year for participation in the loan forgiveness program within the limits of available funding. Now, in this bill, we've got $225,000 requested in the bill. So, you know, it depends on how many people are eligible or want to participate, and we hope we can do this for 5 years. We get them to practice out there for 5 years. So if you drop down to lines 2.22 on page 2, item C, the commissioner must make annual disbursements directly to the participant of $15,000 or the balance of the participant's qualifying educational loan, whichever is less, for each year that the participant meets the service obligation required under Subdivision 3, paragraph B, up to a maximum of 5 years. The number of states in the upper Midwest that are already doing this, one concern we have is that veterinarians that graduate from Minnesota are going to be attracted to some of these other rural states to take advantage of the loan forgiveness program. So we're trying to be competitive on this issue. There's also a fiscal note in your handout and your folders there, as well as some other handouts that explain this in more detail. But what I'd like to do at this time is turn this over to Dr. Trevor Ames, who is the dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine, and he is going to explain this in more detail.
Dr. Ames, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Trevor Ames. I'm the dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine. Thank you, Senator Dill and committee members, for allowing us to come and talk to you about this important need. I don't think I need to spend a lot of time telling this committee about how important agriculture is or how important specifically animal agriculture is to the economy of this state. The College of Veterinary Medicine has a long history of working with animal agriculture and key veterinary college faculty like Al Lehman and Ben Pomeroy have played a role in the success of the swine and poultry industries in this state. The goal of the college is to provide the best possible education to meet the needs of society by protecting the health of animals and the citizens of the state. As this slide illustrates, the role of veterinarians in society is one that bridges animal health and human health, and one that is continually changing. And by protecting animal health and by protecting human health, we feel that we play an important role in protecting the economy of the state and ensuring a safe food supply. And an important first step in meeting society's needs, obviously, is to create a capable workforce that can meet the challenges facing society and agriculture. The educational capacity of the nation's veterinary colleges has not changed significantly in the last 20 years. There's been one new veterinary school open during that time. It's a private veterinary school in Pomona, California. The food animal veterinarians continue to be valued and respected in their rural communities for helping care for animals that sustain families' livelihoods. In addition, the role of public health veterinarians and regulatory veterinarians is never been more important and is increasing in demand. Veterinarians working with this food supply have challenging and rewarding careers, but the increased debt load that is currently occurring with our graduates is driving some of our graduates into small animal practice where there is opportunities for higher salaries. The American Veterinary Medical Association has looked at the number of food animal veterinarians per county and how that relates to the number of food animals in those counties for all states within the nation. As you can see, in Minnesota, there are 14 counties with no veterinarians and a significant number of food animals. You can see that there are approximately 400 food animal veterinarians or mixed animal veterinarians that have to care for over 9 million animals, approximately 9 million animals. And for those of you that are maybe more visual learners, this map kind of shows the areas of the state where there are no veterinarians and high numbers of food animals with the white flags, or the red flags, and then moderate numbers of food animals and no veterinarians with the white flags. And then if you want to just use the color gradients, the red states are the ones that have the highest ratio of food animals to veterinarians within the state. I alluded to the role of the public health veterinarian. This role of this veterinarian has grown a lot in today's society. In responding to issues of globalization and emerging disease, especially those that go between animals and humans, and also those that are involved in foodborne diseases. And I think that the issues involving salmonella and the issue with peanut butter serves to illustrate this example. The Department of Health team that determined that peanut butter was involved long before CDC did was based in Minnesota and was led by a veterinarian. And the importance of the veterinarians in the public health arena is also magnified by the extreme shortage in USDA, in the United States Public Health Service, and in the armed services. The educational costs of a veterinary degree are significant, though they are considerably smaller than that of medical school. So you can see that in 2006, it was estimated that it cost approximately $210,000 to train a veterinary student. In contrast, a master's student costs $43,000, a PhD student $81,000, and a master's of public health costs $80,000. Our average student indebtedness is about $130,000, and you can see the resident and non-resident tuition figures. And you can also see the salary figures for starting salaries between small animal and large animal practices. I would like to introduce Amber Hazel, who will graduate from the College of Veterinary Medicine in 2012. She's the vice president for cattle in our Production Animal Medicine Club, and she is also the American Veterinary Medical Association National Legislative Delegate for the College of Veterinary Medicine of the University of Minnesota. Amber was also a summer intern for Colin Peterson this past summer. Amber was accepted through our VetFast program, which I'll explain in more detail in a minute, and she grew up on a dairy farm in Lanesboro, Minnesota. I've asked Amber to come with me today to talk about her financial situation, her career circumstances, and maybe some of those of her classmates. Amber?
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Hazel. If you'd state your name for the record. And
sure, of course. My name is Amber Hazel, and I am a first-year DVM student at the University of Minnesota, and I would like to thank the chairman and the rest of the committee members for giving me the privilege today to speak to you about this important issue. And I come today not only as a representative of the rest of my class, but also as a representative of the rest of DVMs here in Minnesota, because this is a very important issue to us students. As Dr. Ames had alluded to, the vast majority of us graduate with at least $130,000 in debt. And for those of us who are large animal veterinarians, we will only receive $62,000 in compensation upon graduation. And that is significantly smaller than our small animal counterparts, who will receive $80,000 upon graduation. So this is a very important piece of legislation for us. And I grew up on a dairy farm in southeast Minnesota. I am very familiar with the dairy industry, and I also have a few beef cattle at home, which my brother and I raise. Upon graduation with my DVM, I hope to get a PhD and specialize specifically in dairy cattle veterinary medicine, and hope to take some consulting roles here in Minnesota along the dairy side. As far as a large animal veterinarian, our role in Minnesota is very significant. We touch upon public health, the public health arena, which Dr. Ames alluded to earlier, but we also protect against foreign animal disease outbreaks, animal welfare concerns, which are an increasing issue today in animal agriculture. And then finally, one of the big items that was talked about today was the economics of the dairy industry and how important that is currently. Margins are tight everywhere, and it's not just the dairy industry, it's the beef industry, it's swine, it's poultry, it's everywhere. So our role as a food animal veterinarian is to step onto that farm and say, this is where you could possibly become more economical. This is where you could improve the health of your animals and therefore increase your productivity on your dairy or on your farm. So as a as a prospective food animal veterinarian, I would highly encourage you to consider this legislation. It is very important to us, and I would be happy to take questions if you have any.
Any questions? Senator Kubley?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I guess, thanks to you, Dr. Ames, for the tour of the lab. That was quite interesting. But, Senator Dale, I guess my question is probably to you. I guess, you know, you have in here that you're eligible for a $15,000 participating, you know, to apply toward your qualifying loans for five people. But what am I missing here? I mean, you know, if you divide five into 225,000, that's 45,000 a year, but yet you're only allowing up to 15. Can you just expand on that a little bit?
Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Kubley, it depends on how many people jump in at the start. We're thinking 15,000 per year, and if there's three the first year, that's 45,000, and then there's a two-year biennium that we're dealing with, so then it's a five-year program, so then they'd be eligible for another 45,000 the next year.
Okay.
Next year, you'd be adding another three or four or five. We're thinking three to five per year. And it continues on for each year, so you get kind of a multiplier. Each subsequent year, it requires additional money to service all the loans that are out there, assuming that all the veterinarians fall through and stay in the rural community for 5 years.
Yeah, well, Ms. Chair and Senator Dedell, maybe you covered that in putting the bill together, but that wasn't clear as I read through it, and I couldn't find it, so thank you for that.
Mr. Chairman?
Oh, Dr. Ames.
I just have a couple more slides that maybe can answer a few more questions, with your permission.
You go right ahead, Dr. Ames.
So I just I kind of wanted to draw people's attention to what's going on in the small animal practice realm. The Banfield Hospitals own approximately 700 veterinary hospitals within the nation. They're the largest employers of veterinarians. And they are predicting a very significant increase in demand for veterinarians going into the future. This is supported by reports from the Bureau of Labor Statistics as well. And so this increased demand within the small animal sector has very significant effects throughout the profession. In Minnesota, 80% of the licensed veterinarians are graduates of the College of Veterinary Medicine. We continue to have an extremely strong applicant pool for students applying to our veterinary college. It's one of the largest in the nation. And for years, we have offered a significant amount of electivity for our students so that they can start to specialize to some degree within veterinary school to gain the needed expertise to succeed in segments like the agricultural segment. But like a lot of veterinary colleges, the University of Minnesota in the late 1990s started to see a decline in the number of food animal students that were applying to go into food animal practice. And so there was a large task force that was set up by the American Association of Veterinary, the American Veterinary Medical Association, the American Association of Bovine Practitioners, and the American Association of Swine Veterinarians, to try and get a handle on what was going on with this, as they called it, food supply, veterinary medicine, manpower issue, and I should say person power, but that's what they called the study. And Dr. Fetro, who's with me here today as well, also did an economic study and manpower study in Minnesota as well, looking at this supply issue. And basically, the major recommendations broke down to an issue of recruitment, that there needed to be stronger recruitment in rural areas, that if we can get rural students applying to veterinary medicine, they have the greatest likelihood of returning to those areas. We needed to use our rural veterinary role models to help with that recruiting, and certainly we've provided our veterinarians in the state with recruiting materials, and that they needed to develop an early admissions program, which I'll talk about in a minute. There needed to be good mentorship once they were in the veterinary college with adequate number of food animal faculty. And an important point is that there needs to be a critical mass of food animal students. If there's not a certain number of students within the college, They don't have anyone to talk to. And we saw that in the late 1990s where students that came in with wonderful farm animal backgrounds decided to go into small animal emergency medicine. There needs to be incentives like scholarships, and we've been very encouraged by the positive response we've seen to our VetFast program, with many retiring veterinarians contributing to scholarships for this early admissions program, and then the loan forgiveness program that we're talking about today. And then when the students are in veterinary school, they need to be prepared adequately so they can succeed when they go into specialized segments of the profession. They need to be aware of what they're getting into when they go into these different segments, and they need to have the training and facilities that allow them to succeed. And so I just wanted to talk a little bit about what we've done at the University of Minnesota since the early 2000s to deal with this. We have changed our admissions process within the college, so we no longer select solely on GPA or graduate record exam. We also rely heavily on an interview process that selects for students that have behavioral competencies that we've shown are associated with success in the profession. So this interview is an important part of how we select veterinary students. There are students with 4.0 GPAs that do not get into our veterinary college if they do not have these traits to predict for success in the profession. We've put in place this VetFast program. We've already graduated our first graduates out of this program last year. We're way ahead of the rest of the nation in doing this. Currently, we have about 10 to 15 students in the sophomore and junior classes of animal science at the University of Minnesota, as well as each year of our veterinary college. Our goal, our stated goal, is to have 20 of these students a year so that we can meet the needs of the state. And in addition to giving these students early admission and early decision, they still have to go 3 years in animal science, then they move into veterinary college for 4 years. They get both degrees in 7 years. They have to do mentored experiences in pre-vet as well as in veterinary school with a food animal practice, with a food animal pharmaceutical company, with a research project, so that they understand the profession. They also have to take the food animal track when they're in veterinary school. And the veterinary school has also collaborated with the School of Public Health to have a combined DVM-MPH program, Masters of Public Health, to train these public health professionals for veterinary medicine. We have the largest program in the nation. It's larger than all of the other schools put together. So we are training over 110 of these professionals a year in our program right now. So we feel like we're doing a lot to meet the nation's need for these veterinarians that work at USDA, that work in regulatory practice. We also place a lot of emphasis on experiential education. From the day our students walk into veterinary school, they get their hands on animals. They get experience, and they're out with practitioners, and so we think that's important. Not only do we select for students that have the right behavioral competencies, we also emphasize leadership training and mentorship and developing professional skills like communication skills and problem solving while they're in veterinary school. A really important thing I want to emphasize is that we've placed a lot of emphasis on having outstanding educational programs and facilities to train our veterinary students. And we've done a lot of public-private partnerships so that we have farm-based experiences with a dairy teaching farm, a small ruminant teaching farm, and a swine teaching farm. And I'd just like to highlight, because it's Dairy Day, that we have a partnership with Davis Family Farms, where we will create a dairy education facility where our students will live on a dairy farm and will be exposed to 6,000 cows a year going through this system. This facility, we are building the educational part of this facility on the dairy farm, and we've received significant support from the lending institutions of the state, from pharmaceutical companies, from nutritional companies, to create an educational facility of sufficient quality and size that we qualify for very specific language in the Farm Bill, the Federal Farm Bill, so that we can have a national center of excellence in training dairy veterinarians. And so we're applying for that funding, and Dr. Fetcher, who's with me today, has been a very important lead in us applying for that particular funding through the Federal Farm Bill. Our diagnostic lab is also a wonderful training site for veterinary students, and it also fulfills a major role supporting the producers of the state and the veterinarians in making daily decisions, the wildlife managers of the state, the public health veterinarians of the state in making their daily decisions. And it is the main veterinary support lab for the Board of Animal Health. And then today what we're here about is I have worked with Senator Dill over the last year to find a way to create a state-based loan forgiveness program. And Senator Dill has authored this bill that he's just described to you today. He's talked to you about the key features of this bill, so I don't think I need to go through those details again. I would just say that we're the only health professional that doesn't have a loan forgiveness program. USDA currently has about $700,000 nationally that they are committing to a loan forgiveness program. That's for the nation. And so I think if you heard about some of the student debt that Amber talked about, that probably isn't going to go very far, but it's the first step. So thank you very much for your attention today. Our goal is to have more food animal veterinarians helping the agricultural industry of Minnesota.
Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to any of the witnesses, I guess, I had a couple items that I was wondering about. First, are farmed cervidae and poultry included in food animals? I'm sure poultry are food, but, you know,
yes.
Are they included in the definition of food
yes.
animals? They are.
Yes.
And farmed cervidae
yes.
as well? Okay, thank you. I guess...
Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Ames, when you talk about the VET FAST program, are those students then losing out on a portion of the training that the vets that aren't, or the student vets that aren't included in that,
no.
You know, that they would have, or, you know, how do they, is it the same level of training, I guess, is what I'm asking for both programs?
Mr. Chair.
Dr. Ames.
The veterinary students, they take 3 years to do their degree, their first 3 years in animal science. Then they move in and do 4 years within the veterinary college. They get both degrees in 7 years because some of the credits in the first 2 years of veterinary college count towards their animal science degree. The most of our students that come into veterinary college have 3 or 4 years of training prior to getting into veterinary college. It's technically possible to get into veterinary college with 2 years of pre-vet training, but no one has done it yet. Although we do have a 19-year-old in this year's class who I think took a lot of high school university classes. So I would say that they are very typical of the same number of years of education as the average veterinary student. And we've been very encouraged that most of these students that are accepted through this program are in the top quarter of their class. So they seem to be very motivated, very directed students, and they seem to do very well within the veterinary curriculum.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions. First, Ms. Hazel, thank you for being here. Great testimony. And I just want to give a high ho for southeastern Minnesota. She's from one of my cities, Lanesboro area. And I have run into Hazel members in rural Peterson who are 4-H people, so they're probably related to you. But thank you very much for your testimony. Senator Dill, you mentioned at one point about other states who are going ahead with this loan forgiveness program. And are we at risk that those states would recruit away our large animal vets and offer them their loan forgiveness? And then following up on that, do we have provisions in here, or are we going to be trying to do the same thing, recruit vets who have been trained in another state, and could they come to Minnesota and be reimbursed with Minnesota loan forgiveness programs?
Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Erickson-Ropes, if you look on the first page of the bill, on the definition section, lines 1.10, it defines a veterinarian. And it means an individual has been awarded a Doctor of Veterinary Medicine degree from the College of Veterinary Medicine, University of Minnesota. So that limits the program only to Minnesota graduates. But to answer the question about what other states are doing, I know other states have some similar programs, but I'll let Dr. Ames answer that. But I think he knows it better than I do.
Okay.
Dr. Ames.
Mr. Chairman, certainly states that don't have a veterinary school like North Dakota are offering their loan forgiveness to students graduating from any veterinary college. And I don't know the specifics for Iowa and Wisconsin. Wisconsin has not passed their legislation yet. It is still, I guess, working its way through the process.
Okay. Senator Erickson-Robes.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Senator Dillon, Dr. Ames, because I think there's other opportunities where states tend to raid our resources away. So I'm just a little bit concerned. Do we know how many of the students that graduate from the university migrate to other states, or do they mostly stay in our state so they can benefit from these loan forgiveness programs?
The best figure I can give you is that 80% of the practicing veterinarians in the state are trained at our veterinary school. We don't have the perfect tracking on over time about where all our students are coming and going.
Okay. Then, Mr. Chair, one last question. And then, Dr. Ames, this is to you. A couple times today in your presentation, you mentioned behavioral competencies associated with success in the profession. What does that mean?
Dr. Ames.
Mr. Chairman, we, in response to a large study that was done in the late 1990s that suggested that, you know, not only do you need knowledge and skills to succeed in the profession, you need certain attitudes and aptitudes. We started working with a local company called Professional Decisions International that does this with corporations. And we interviewed together with some other states what we called 3,000 successful veterinarians. They were veterinarians that were nominated by at least five people as being successful in their profession. And so this corporation, or this PDI as they're called, interviewed those veterinarians and determined what are the traits that make them successful. So a lot of them are traits that you might expect, things like emotional resilience, problem-solving skills, communication skills, those sorts of traits. And so we developed a very specific interview tool that take students through 11 sort of sets of questions with many additional follow-up questions and to get at these sorts of behavioral traits that we think are associated with successful veterinarians.
Thank you, Dr. Ames. I think that's great, and I congratulate you for stepping away from just strictly an academic profile, because there's a lot of really great people and potential vets out there that may not have just a 4.0 average. And if your competition is 1,100 applications for 90 spots, you really need to be looking at more than just academics. So, well done.
Senator Engelbrechtson was next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question to Mr. Ames. First of all, thank you so much for the report. The best I can count here as I scan through this information, you have 400, right around 400 and some large animal or food animal vets in the state of Minnesota. Is that correct?
Correct.
First of all, how does that compare to other states? And how many animal units is that per doctor, per veterinarian? And another question that just came to me, and I'm going to have to stand somewhat puzzled here. Large animal versus food animal, they don't cross over at all at veterinarians? A lot of questions there.
Dr. Ames.
Chairman. The distinction between large animal and food animal is mainly around horses. And so the issue of looking at these person power issues really focused around the need for veterinarians working in what's called food supply veterinary medicine, so veterinarians that are involved with on-farm care, through veterinarians that are involved in government work that ensure that the products are safe, through veterinarians that are involved in public health to make sure that there's no adverse effects going on. So that became a term that was called food supply veterinary medicine or food animal veterinarians. And so the real difference is that large animal veterinarians, you know, work on all large animals, including horses, but they've been taken out of this sort of food equation. In terms of your question about other states, certainly the number of veterinarians working on food animals kind of tracks pretty closely with the states that have large food animal industries. So obviously Iowa, Wisconsin, you know, that have a large number of food animals also have similar numbers to Minnesota, whereas states, you know, that have a smaller amount of food animal production then have a much smaller number. The data point that I have is not specifically what you asked about in terms of animal units. The animals per veterinarian, and this is including all food animals, so it would include dairy cattle, swine, and poultry, is 21,000 per veterinarian.
Just to follow up, is that, that's pretty high?
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Scully.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Dill, I think you've got a really good idea, and I think these loan forgiveness programs have been effective in recruiting people into the professions to serve where we want them to or where the needs are. Unfortunately, I think you're going to run into the Finance Committee at some point this year, and you're going to have a little difficulty. But I have a suggestion. I don't normally suggest this kind of thing because I don't think it's good for our long-term budgeting, but because these classes of vets are already in this College of Veterinary Sciences, I would suggest perhaps you would apply this loan forgiveness programs to next year's freshman class. You could do a couple things. You could recruit students that have an interest in large animal veterinary, but it would also get you offline for the budget, because they won't graduate for 4 years and they wouldn't need any money for 4 years to pay back their loan forgiveness. So when you head off to the Finance Committee, you might want to consider that. You're going to have to draw a line somewhere where students are eligible and where they aren't. You might want to consider moving your line out 4 years to help you in the Finance Committee.
Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scully, what you're suggesting is to get the language and law, or worry about the money later.
Well, and you could apply it to the next year's freshman class, so it would be a recruiting tool for Dr. Ames to recruit people with interest in large animal sciences, so that when they graduate, there would be a loan forgiveness program for them. But you're going to run into trouble in the Finance Committee if you try to make this effective next year, I would think.
Senator Dill.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoia, the one thing that's missing, though, is the commitment to go to the distant areas of the country as a freshman. They may not be quite ready to make that commitment, but maybe they would. But even so, just having the language and law with the possibility of having this program in place by the time they graduate would be helpful.
Just a suggestion, Senator Dill. I think it might help you.
Dr. Ames.
Mr. Chairman. I would second what Senator Dill said, is that the real decision process takes place not so much when they're coming in, because there's a lot of students have a strong interest. The real decision takes place when they're getting ready to graduate and deciding what exactly they're going to do. So I think that even knowing that this money could become available and could be applied would make a difference in decision-making. Thank you.
Before you, Senator Kubley, I actually have a question. Mr. Knopf, if you could explain, I still don't quite understand the fiscal note where it shows that it's $225,000 in 2010, but the way I understand it, that's spread over 5 years. Is that, or
Mueller.
Mr. Mueller, okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, the way that they're describing the fiscal note, this $225,000 will only be available for one round of applicants. So they would be spread over a five-year period. The wording of the fiscal note says, you know, 3 to 5 awards be made, and there would be no second round of applicants the following year unless other participants left the program or until more money was appropriated. So the money that's in the bill right now is basically set up for one batch of applicants.
So my question is why are we appropriating all in one year if we're going to spread it out over 5 years? Why wouldn't we do it so much per year?
Mr. Chairman, the wording of the bill right now says the money is available till spent. I suppose you could look at it that way, and it would lower the amount the first year, get it into the base, and then make that amount available each year. That would lower the cost.
Wouldn't that lower it to $45,000 or whatever it would be? Or?
I think it's because of the commitment, though, too.
Pardon me?
Well, Mr. Chairman, part of the reason I think that the appropriation has done that way is because you're making a long-term commitment for 5 years. You know, these people are going to basically sign on to go work in an area for 5 years, and you want to make sure that the money is there and that you don't have to basically go by the whims of the legislature for future funding. Okay.
So then would this have to be reauthorized after 5 years then, or would it be ongoing, or how does it read?
Mr. Chairman, the way the bill is structured right now, it is just a one-time appropriation for one set of applicants, but the program would still be in statute and, you know, could pick up extra people whenever more money is appropriated to it. But.
All right. Yes,
Mr. Chairman?
Actually, Senator Kubley has a question.
Well, yeah, not so much a question as a suggestion, Senator Dale. I think Senator Scoy's idea might work. I think that's a good idea. But I think this is an important bill that would really help out the rural areas of the state. And, you know, I'd like to suggest the possibility of putting some language in here that would capture a portion of any federal stimulus program that might come to the agricultural community of the states. And, you know, just have a dollar value in there that would be available up to an amount that could actually be used. And I'm sure that Dr. Ames could make sure that money was used in any given year. But I think this is important enough. We ought to go with the whole amount and the possibility of capturing it in that way from any stimulus payment that might come from the feds.
I would also make the members aware that I've been told that we're not going to move this out of here to the Finance Committee. We're actually going to lay it over for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill. So that's what has been instructed to me.
Well,
Senator Dale.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask Senator Cooley, are you kind of picking up on what Dr. Ames said earlier about the federal money, the $700,000 or somebody mentioned those?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Dale, I guess, you know, we had looked at a spreadsheet this morning that looked at the different areas that money would be available in, and there was an agricultural component, and so that's what I was referring to, that if that money becomes available and comes to the state, well, it seems to me that if we only have 60 days or so to commit the money, we need to have some things ready to go, and I think this would be a piece that I think this committee would be in pretty much in agreement on, that we would like to see it move ahead.
Dr. Ames?
Just to clarify, the $700,000 that USDA currently administers was allocated 2 or 3 years ago. USDA didn't find a way of distributing that money. It was specifically for loan forgiveness at the national level for veterinarians. And in the last farm bill, they were given very specific directions that they had to be more timely in distributing the money at the national level. So that's money that was, allocated in previous legislation. I just wanted to follow up. I've neglected to sort of emphasize the rationale for the five-year period. And that came out of this study that looked at this manpower issue. And basically what they found was that if veterinarians stayed in a rural community for more than 5 years, they were far more likely to spend their career in that rural community than if they left, you know, if they only stayed for 2 or 3 years. Or so basically staying in a specific community for a period of time made that become their lifelong sort of career specialization. And the other interesting thing that was found out of that study is they actually looked at job satisfaction rates between different parts of the profession, and veterinarians that worked in these rural communities had the highest job satisfaction rate of any part of the profession.
Senator Dale.
Mr. Chairman, does Mr. Knopf know how to craft language to encompass what Senator Kubley is talking about?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, I mean, that would be fairly easy, I think, to craft something that would pick up any federal money. You know, currently, right now, any federal money that comes down, there's a statutory appropriation for that money for whatever purpose. But if you wanted to make sure that it got captured here, it would make some sense to put something in here to do that. Because otherwise, it's pretty much up to the governor if it comes to the governor on how it's spent.
So is that, Mr.
Senator Chairman, Dale.
Mr. Knopf, is that something we should do now, or should we be looking at that when we put together the omnibus bill?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dale, I think you should do that when you put together the omnibus bill instead of putting it on the fly now, because this, there'll have to be something included from this in the omnibus bill, as long as there's money available, or if there's no money available to capture that money. We can do that at that point in time.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Dale, you know, I guess, well, I think, Senator Scoy, you were there when Congressman Peterson was here, and Senator Langseth was there, too. Wasn't he talking about kind of a 60-day window where we had to commit these dollars? And so, you know, it would seem to me, Senator Dale, that it might be beneficial to add it now. And if we add it now and that, and you know, I think if we add it, maybe we ought to take it off the table and move it forward as a standalone bill, just to have the best assurance that we can capture those dollars in the way that we intend to.
Senator Dill, what's your wishes? It's your bill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Kubley and Langseth and Scully, I wasn't in the Colin Peterson meeting, so I don't know exactly what. I'd have to leave it up to you and Mr. Knopf to figure out what words to add here, but it certainly sounds like something that sounds encouraging to me, that there may be some federal money to help out on this.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Dill, I wasn't in the meeting either. It was prior. But my thought is, if it's going to go on the table, you can put it on the table and add the language when you take it off or when you do the omnibus bill. You know, if there's an issue about drafting it today, just put the bill on the table. And wherever it comes off the table, you can put the language in, and that'll give the staff time to prepare the appropriate words.
Actually, before you, Senator, I elevated your position. Mr. Michaels,
or
I
not.
Think, can shed some light on things here.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, I too was in the meeting with Congressman Peterson, and I believe that he was talking about stimulus money that was going to come down in terms of loan guarantees and loan monies that would be available to local bankers and FSA system. And he also talked about modernizing the computerization of the FSA offices and the USDA. And some clean water money that would be available to communities, but I don't recall that agriculture in general was going to receive any stimulus money. So I think that's something we'd have to look at and get some clarification on. Right now, the money would come out of the Department of Agriculture's budget. There's a possibility there could be some higher education monies that could be tapped, but then that would be outside of our budget area. It would have to go to finance then if we change it to higher education.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I recall what you do, Mr. Michaels, about that meeting. It seems to me when they were talking about the 60-day window, at least the way I remember it, was more in relation to construction projects as well. So I don't know that it would have to do with agriculture in this venue.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langseth.
We can pick this bill up at any meeting and
certainly
and do what we want to. So we meet, what, twice a week or something, we can have a better idea. I think they're talking about getting that to the president Monday. I don't know if they'll make it or not, but we'll have a little better idea of what the possibilities might be.
Okay. So, Senator Dill, do you want to just move to lay it over for possible inclusion into the omnibus agricultural bill?
Yes,
and then maybe continue to work on the language.
I'll make that motion.
Tom Peterson, come up.
The only other thing I'd like to point out to the chair is that Tom Peterson's on the list to testify.
Yes.
I don't know if he wants to say anything at this point or not.
Mr. Peterson, or anybody else that wants to come and testify on this bill? Dr. Hartman, did you want to testify also, or? Go ahead, Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name's Tom Peterson, and I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. Just be very brief, and we support this bill, and we've worked on it. I met with Doug Peterson. I met with Dr. Ames about a year ago and talked about this, and we're concerned. And just from a producer side, we are hearing, you know, it's not that you can't get a veterinarian. It's just that you have to wait longer to get a veterinarian in some parts of the state, and it costs more for the call to get out in those parts of the state. And so that's what we were hearing, too, from farmers. And we started inquiring and talking to Senator Dill, and I started looking at other states because I saw Wisconsin last year was moving this legislation. And then also I just see that looking that as of June 2008, the American Veterinary Medical Association said that 13 other states, including North Dakota, have established some kind of program to provide educational debt relief to veterinarian school graduates who agree to pursue jobs in underserved areas. And so we just do see the need there and want to think ahead on this, too. So appreciate your consideration. And one other thing I'd add on the stimulus bill, I've been looking at that quite a bit, too, and I haven't seen a veterinarian piece in there or something that might work. But if there is something in there, you know, like Senator Langseth said, you could move that pretty quick, I think. So,
thank you, Mr. Peterson. Dr. Haggerty, I'm sorry about that.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, you have a big heart,
and so I was just calling you Hartman, so I'm sorry about Dr. Haggerty.
I'm Tom Haggerty. I'm a veterinarian, and I'm representing the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association. And I understand why you mixed me up with Dr. Hartman, because he is getting grayer and grayer and grayer. And don't tell him I said that. I just want to reiterate the fact that the MVMA Association, Veterinary Association, strongly supports this initiative to attempt to encourage some of our veterinary graduates to go into the underserved area. And I'll just tell you that in the practice where I spent a greater part of my career, which I think is outside of this area, used to have six veterinarians now doing large animal. Now, the large animal work has decreased in that particular clinic, but they've never been able in the last 10 years to find people that would come in and do the large animal work. So the old hands that were in there kept doing it and doing it and doing it, and now finally they're retiring, so there's one person left doing the large animal work, which means 7 days a week, day and night. And pretty soon that person will get tired and get out of it too. So it is a real, real problem, and I think this is one way to help stimulate some interest. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, any further questions? No further questions. Senator Dill moves that Senate File 132 be laid over for possible inclusion into the Ag Omnibus Bill. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Members have an announcement. There will be no committee meeting on this Thursday. Next week, the committee will begin its review of the governor's budget recommendations for the Department of Agriculture. And if there's no other business to come before this committee, the committee is adjourned. Okay.